Can I have a minute to go grab a beer?
And yeah, take, go for it.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. It's 3 o'clock.
Yeah, keeping score there.
In tech we trust. In charge we're not sure about.
Colonel Panicking and Blue Screen of Deathing our way into this episode of the In Tech We Definitely Should Not Trust podcast. I think I'm going to call this episode 3.1, and I gotta tell you, it hurts the reason why it's 3.1 and not just plain old 3.
Can't you call it 10?
Well, I'm going to come to something like that in a second, actually. So we actually recorded this show yesterday, and I thought it was a cracking show. I don't know what you guys thought.
Yeah. Oh,
I thought it was all right. It was good.
I kind of thought it was the best yet.
It was, you know, it could have been on the air. It was good enough for that. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But right at the death, yours truly here try something clever. And, well, you know, just talking about it, it's practically giving me the shakes here. Long story short, I crashed Skype and my call recording software. And the audio file did a fine impression of any data that's left on an Extreme IO during a destructive upgrade from version 2 to version 3. And it disappeared off the face of the planet. So
we're not going to get a Christmas card from Chad.
Nah. They can take it on the chin. They're big guys and they roll with it with the best of them, right? But today's a new day, right? And actually, you know, in honor of Microsoft, maybe we should skip an episode number and call it episode 5 or something, because that seems the cool thing to do these days.
Well, you know, it was funny that you mentioned that, because there was I've read an article today about the reason, or the likely reason, due to the name skip of 9 was due to some code issue.
I read the same thing, yeah. Can I just do something, though? Can I just slam on the brakes there and just let the listeners know who we've got on the show this week, because we are mixing and matching each week. So, Gabriel, you've been ever-present on the show, right? So I probably don't even need to announce you.
I have nothing better to do.
There you go. And then Rick Vanover.
Hey.
Yeah, and thank Mark you. Farley. Hey. A year older as well, Mark. Do you feel wiser or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, I feel real wise.
Cool. So go on then. Let's talk about Windows. And maybe we probably should start the ball rolling with something a bit lighthearted and about the name or the number or whatever we want to call it, right? What are our thoughts on that? Windows 10.
Ooh, I mean, you know, it just got such derision from all over the place, right? And it's hard not to react to that or respond to that without trying to think of something funny to say. Right. And I think one of the favorite things that I saw, you know, was the German interpretation. They didn't want it to say Windows No.
Oh, yeah, very good, yeah.
That's a good one. Well, you know, it's got to have a change. You know, they're not dealing with the best of situations. You know, it's trying to advocate a big experience across all types of devices. I like Windows 8, 8.1. I'm in the minority there and server equivalent.
No, I'm with you there, Rick. I like it.
But, you know, they can't sit still, you know, so it's got to change, I guess, put it that way.
And do you think by skipping a number, they're kind of giving the impression that they're distancing themselves even further from that 8 experience?
No, I think it's just, I think it's marketing, it's a position, it's a test market survey. And yeah, the German equivalent there, that's an interesting one. But I think it's going to change again, too. It's not going to go to 11, 12 all the way up, you know.
So, Gabriel, you were talking about some coding where, is it the thing where the third-party apps might do a search for Windows 9 and then star and pick it up as 95 or 98, something like that?
They said something, if I remember correctly from the article, it said that the number skip was a reaction to shorthand used by the programmers back when they were doing 95 and 98.
Mm-hmm.
And so the coders would basically write down, you know, Windows 9 dot or 9X to refer to either of those two Windows versions. And so somewhere within there that caused an issue with some existing code, and they decided to basically skip it. Now, who knows if that's legit or not? Obviously, you know, anything you read on Reddit is open for interpretation, but it's interesting to say the least.
Well, did you look at that site though, where it showed all the different code samples from different programs and whatnot? It's pretty sizable number of demonstrations of things that search for Windows 9, you know, splat.
So you're giving credence to that, yeah? You think there's some weight behind that?
Seems legit to me.
Well, it's a funny handler, because it's one of those things that it might try to work, but it may not work. I actually got onto a Twitter conversation with Jason Bakke and Matthew Lieb. I actually use Quicken 6 from 1995, but I installed the patch from 1996, so I'm good. I literally use the oldest version of Quicken, and it works great on Windows 8. But you know, don't worry, I got the patch from 96, so I'm good. But you know, if you have a really old app like that, it might work and it might be okay, but it might not either. So you don't know.
You know what I think would have been cool for a name, right? Total marketing thing, but Windows 1, and not the number 1, but O-N-E.
O-N-E.
Yeah, like they've got Xbox One and OneDrive. And
Veeam One and all those other good ones too.
Veeam One. You know what? We need to talk about that a little bit later.
Why don't they just call it One OS then and just drop Windows altogether?
That's a great idea.
Or OS X.
Because Microsoft wouldn't know how to go about branding if they didn't have Windows, right? Everything branded from Microsoft has to have five syllables. Microsoft Windows, right? Well, it's like chopping off an arm.
Yeah. Hey, did they go through a rebranding thing for Azure recently? Did that used to be Windows Azure and it's now Microsoft Azure, or is
right.
it the other way around?
Yes, so, yes, they did. Yeah, they went from Windows Azure to Microsoft Azure.
Azure or Azure?
Azure.
Azure. Okay.
No, I don't think there's a right way to say it. It's a great hilarity too that continues to go in different vectors.
I love it.
Oh, it'll change too. Just like VMware has changed their cloud solution to vAir or whatever.
MacBook Air in the cloud or something.
Well, vCheese was hard to wrap your head around.
So was vChess.
Hey Rick, you're a bit of an Apple fanboy, aren't you?
Negative.
You've got an Apple Mac or something, right?
No. That's Gabe. I got rid of everything. Once I got my Surface, I retired the iPad. Don't even know how to spell it.
Oh, right.
iPad.
Okay. So I should ask Gabriel this question then. So for Mac OS, is it OS X or OS 10?
I would think that it's OS X, to be honest, though, but I'm fairly new to the world of Mac.
See,
so
I kind of thought it was OS 10, and then Rick said OS X. But that kind of made, Microsoft have got heritage in copying Apple, right? So they could have, for this Windows 10, gone Windows X and really just plagiarized Apple again. That would have been a great thing. Surprised they didn't do that.
That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
But I posted a little cartoon this morning on my blog, Data on Top. I think they should have called it Windows Unsuck.
Yeah. Oh,
man. Ex-Microsoft guy, that's just mean.
Well, you think about it, though. I mean, so much of what Microsoft does is still catering to the legacy applications. I mean, there are still, I guarantee you, there are still companies out there running 16-bit apps that somehow are a line of business critical function that they need to do that there's no way for them to migrate off to, and they're either too cheap or just too short-sighted to actually make the transition to some other platform.
Kind of like me and Quicken at home.
Yeah, well, yours is probably 8-bit, Rick.
I don't know. I have to click a little option to make it go in full color.
No, do you run that in a VM?
No, I run it on my
compatibility mode.
No,
you should just run it on your phone, dude.
3.1.
It works, man. I'm telling you.
But you know what? I think that's a really good segue, actually, into a more serious conversation about Windows 10, because it seems like, dangerously, I think, it's trying to be all things to all people in some respects. And there's this talk about universal apps, right? And I mean, Windows obviously doing a pretty good job there right now for Rick if it's running a piece of software that's potentially 8 or probably 16-bit, but from back in the mid-90s, and it still runs. But I think that's a good segue to talk about the universal apps. Does anybody even have a clue what Microsoft means by a universal app?
I think what they want to do is provide services that applications, can find commonly on all these different platforms.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if an app's going to run on different platforms, it needs to be able to, use resources on those machines, whether they're networking resources, storage resources, memory resources. Well, the memory sources are, you know, a lot of, all that stuff is provided by the OS, right? And so I think they're trying to provide some sort of core service provider inside these different platforms so that the applications can run there. I mean, Lord knows they need, you know, everything they can get for their freaking phone.
Yeah. So are you itching, Mark, to take that bottle opener app that you reviewed and run that on your desktop at home? Yeah, I'm sure you are.
Yeah, I want to pick the thing up off the floor and duct tape a bottle opener to it. Or try to get a piece of aluminum underneath the flip top on a can.
Yeah. But you know what? Seriously, does anybody think there's danger in doing that, in trying to be all things to all people? Or do you think there's actually a need for that kind of an app that you develop for a Windows phone to be at least portable enough to run on a server?
I don't mind the portability aspect of it, but then sometimes you're developing to the lowest common denominator when it comes to terms of performance and certain aspects like that, right?
Yeah.
That's it. You know, it's like, you know, master, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, right? And so one thing really well, but you do a couple things really, really well.
Right, it would be a lack of efficient. Well, take a look back, guys. We do a lot of cooler things now, but the data center I had back in 1996 when I got Quicken 6 or whatever, Quicken 5, the data center I supported for a $500 million company, that data center from a compute standpoint was less powerful than the phone I run around with on my neck, storage included, okay? Yeah.
Hey, so, Rick, do you still have the installation diskettes for that?
It doesn't need an install. It's a flat. You just put this DLL in and you're good. Yeah.
You can put it in the cloud.
Copy that. And run Quicken 6 in Azure. I'll do it. I'll give it a try. Anyways, but here's the thing, though. Code had to be efficient back in the day, but now it doesn't really have to. And it honestly, I'm tired of the craplication. And if they put user experience first and infrastructure consequence second, that sucks.
It absolutely does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it
but how
sucks.
How do you put user experience first when the interface and everything on a phone is like just a world apart from what it is on a desktop and a server and whatever it is you have on your smart TV? It's just not the same.
Yeah, but they're not going to have interfaces, though, right? They're going to have different interfaces for different types of devices. That's what they're talking about.
I thought that's what Core was all about, that transition to Core, to kind of streamline or strip down the OS at the server level and then have the more, you know, the Metro UI, the more visible GUI. I mean, I still always – the thing that always perplexed me as an administrator was, why do I need a web browser that's integrated into the operating system for mm-hmm. server? You know, it's things like that that are still, yeah. It's like one more thing to patch constantly, one more application to continually keep up to date. And, it was kind of one of these things where it's like I always thought that they just weren't really quite thinking through how people were deploying the system.
No, I'll tell you why, Gabriel. It was because the Core OS came from desktop and was given to the server team. The server OS isn't generated on its own, and it came from Core Windows OS, and so the services that came with it were integrated too, and it wasn't really possible to rip that out.
I mean, video codecs and video player for my Windows Exchange server? I mean,
absolutely not.
Exactly not.
And this is the problem. This is the problem of trying to have code portability across everything that happens to include server also.
Well, that's hilarious because when Windows 8 and Server 2012 came out, a quote-unquote feature was touted that it was the same code base. But that's actually not new, I guess.
So 2012 is a little different insofar that I think the server group went off and did some things differently. And so, you know, there's an attempt to say to the Windows Core team, we don't want that, we don't need that, right? And that was one of the differences in 2012, is some things were different. If they bring that all together again, where everything generates from, you know, a well of core code that comes from the Windows desktop group, server is going to suffer.
Yeah, when I look at my installation for, like, say, Windows 2012, I need 60 gigs of disk space for all the bloat. If I look at, you know, CentOS, I need 4. Right? So you lose.
It doesn't matter though. Nobody's poor on storage though. That number, everybody touts that, and I don't care because like storage is not the problem.
No, but you do care, Rick, because a second ago, Rick, you were saying that you hate the crap location, right? And I know we're talking about an operating system here, but that 60 gig is bloat, and that is crap that's not needed.
Well, but the 60 gig number is what it needs. It only takes about 8. But you're right. But that the bloat, and especially for a server OS, the bloat is a gateway to do other things. If I want to turn on and make that a web server or a domain controller or a file share or a Hyper-V host, I can run it in PowerShell or run my beautiful server manager and do it. So
but you can do all of that in CentOS as well.
Not a Hyper-V host.
KVM host.
What's that thing? Can't even spell it.
Yeah, but let's say you want to run this thing in high-speed memory, right, and you don't have as much of that. The bloat really does matter. It gets in the way. It fills up, you know, it takes up space that you could be using for real data.
True.
I would much rather move towards a more efficient model than one that continues to bloat. I mean, because, you know, I mean, Windows 2003, yeah, I could get by on a 9 gig installation disk or 13 gig installation disk and then separate it out, right? I mean, we used to, there were some shops that I worked at where it's like C drive was the same regardless of the physical underlying infrastructure. You know, this is pre big time virtualization. But then with each subsequent iteration of the operating system, that drive installation requirement went up.
Well, that's a good point, because the core requirement of what a lot of people do with Windows Server, honestly, granted it's 11 years, hasn't really changed that much. I run it for an app or I run it to host a database. That's a good, fair point, Gabe. You're right. Back in the day, you could do a 9 gig C drive because that's what the drive sizes were. And then it worked nicely inside of a virtual machine, which, by the way, it's going to expire in support 2003 in July of next year. But the base OS is a lot fatter. Okay, so I'll agree with it. But I do like Windows Server, but storage isn't a problem for me.
So do we need the Metro UI for a server OS?
No way.
I like it. I don't know.
Yeah, but not for a server, right? It's totally designed for a touchscreen.
My touchscreen virtual machine?
Well, what do you want on a server?
You can do it.
I mean, what is the right UI for a server console?
Command line?
Yeah, absolutely. Text.
Well, then that
send
would be
a text messages.
Core.
No, I'm kidding. But, you know, I mean, there are a lot of point-and-click admins out there, and there are a lot of people that are wedded to the command line. But I just don't understand, you know, I don't need social integration for my server OS. You know,
yeah,
some of the
yeah,
things
but think,
that I've
but
seen.
Think what you could do, but think what you could do with a joystick.
Or wait,
only
hold
if
on.
It was
could,
Atari 2600 joystick. That's
couldn't
old
I use like a Kinect to move Hyper-V VMs to Azure right
there
from my
go
server? I think that's been done before, actually.
Yeah, you could stand there like Tom Cruise in Minority Report.
Or Extinct, whatever that show was. I started watching it last night based on our review of it in the first episode.
Yeah, it's good. It's worth watching it all the way through to the end as well. Hey, you know what? This discussion about, you know, you're talking about efficiencies and kind of having that one core of the OS from the phone up to the server just really doesn't allow efficiency, in my mind at least. It reminds me of the kind of differences in the Linux kernel used by Android and the Linux kernel out there on servers. And there's so much that's in Android that is just not in the mainline Linux kernel, if I can call it that. You know, power management features and here's a good example. We've just been talking about user interfaces, right? Android doesn't use the X-Window interface that Linux servers do. It's got a graphical subsystem that's tuned for phones, and then the server operating system has got one that's tuned for servers. And there's the kind of common code base between Android and Linux these days is not massive, and that's why Android's so good as a mobile device operating system. And I'd say the same for Linux as a server operating system. There's some common functionality there, but Mark, you were talking about providing like a framework of services like memory management and things like that. I mean, the amount of memory you have in a server these days compared to what you have in a phone, that you can't use the same code base there either, surely.
Yeah, but think about what application portability means, right? There has to be a way for these applications to you know, get resources from the OS. So there has to be some common set of services that the OS provides across these different, you know, classes of devices.
Right, so I think that's the Windows RT, isn't it? The WinRT. They're going to be having that common across all of the different platforms. So the kind of the API or the app service that everybody writes to will be common. But then the rest of it's going to be totally different, I would hope.
Well, I mean, the Android Linux example, I mean, they might even use the same version, sorry to do it, as Bash, right? Yeah, does Android phones, do they run Bash?
You can run Bash on an Android phone, I think. Yeah, I know, you can definitely get shell access to it.
There you go.
But on a phone, you're never going to page to disk or anything, right? But paging to disk is core in most operating systems out there. I think that they're two different worlds, in my opinion.
It's horses for courses. You know, I understand the concept, and I would the simplicity of being able to develop a core single OS that would span across mobile to, you know, tablet to, you know, game console to server to standard PC.
But what a big ask!
But you're going to give up. You're going to have to cut corners around some of those things, and I think that it's, you know, from a development standpoint, you know, you can have a common set of instructions and calls, but I think each one of those different devices presents its own unique set of challenges that need to be addressed and tailored to that particular platform. Because like I said, you're going to sacrifice speed, or you're going to sacrifice security, or you're going to do, you know, it's pick three, or it's pick two out of three, and then, mm-hmm. you know, you're left
you
with the one port. Yeah, you can't have it all.
It's like dedupe. I always tell people, pick one: performance, cost, or overall dedupe. You can't have all three.
Ooh, depends which vendors you're talking to there.
I don't know, man.
I'm just saying that's what the vendors tell you, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's tough to have it all. And I think that, you know, well, the reason why I bring it up, I saw the Android refrigerators and I really want one. The smart fridge, they're really cool. Have you seen those things?
I've not.
No.
Oh, it's like it's basically an Android tablet built into the refrigerator, but it's got all kinds of controls. You can log in. It tells you you're out of ice. You can prep up extra ice. You can know that your water filter's low. You can step it down if you're going to be away. You can crank it up if you're going to really get the beer cold. I was impressed.
You know what that reminds me of, Rick? So I've got a car that I'm pretty sure is running Android, and I've got an Android app for it. And it's a hybrid car, so it's got like a battery and a petrol engine. But my app will tell me stuff like how charged it is, let me turn the lights on when I'm not there, let me turn the heated seats on before I get in. But I tell you what sucks about it, I've got to connect to the car's Wi-Fi with my phone to do that. And as soon as I connect to the car's Wi-Fi, then I don't get emails or anything like that anymore. So I was like, you know, getting the car and thinking, oh, so cool, I've got this app. I'm pretty sure that, you know, the screen on the dashboard's running Android behind the scenes. But it's kind of like, yeah, never going to use the app now. Because as soon as I connect, can't get emails or anything anymore.
So what's wrong with Bluetooth? Does Android not do Bluetooth? It does. Of course it does.
Yeah, it does, yeah. But the app on my phone has to connect over the Wi-Fi.
I know. Still, that is good.
Well, that's like when I fly my drone. Same thing. My drone is Wi-Fi, and I lose my data signal on... Now, here's the thing, Nigel. If it had a Windows... if you had a Windows Surface, and it was on the Wi-Fi... and you had a SIM card in your Surface, I bet it would work, or a laptop.
And I could do that with the Android if it is running Android behind the scenes, but it's got this, like, you know, it's got its own user interface, and it doesn't let me get onto the back end and do stuff like that.
You're going to have to hack your car, dude.
Yeah, I know. How dangerous is that, right? I did think about that, and I thought, you know what, if I screw this up and I take it back to the garage, and I'm like, yeah.
Or maybe your phone, honestly, because, you know, if you're like me, you use a boxed Android, not a hacked Android, right? But computers are capable of being on two different networks at the same time, where one of them would be the cell network and the other one could be a Wi-Fi. But whenever I go to Wi-Fi, my data line goes dim. Because it's thinking the better of it for me. That might be an option, might be a hack Android, but yeah, maybe you could have it all, but there's probably a good reason that your car isn't on the internet, bro.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Especially if it's running Bash.
So Nigel, just pick up a used Windows phone and use that to control your car.
There you
go. That's right.
No, they weren't having that.
Or just duct tape a phone to your dash and
duct tape a phone to your phone.
Yeah, you can guarantee there won't be a Windows app for it. Hey, we've got, I kind of dragged it off piece there. Is anybody actually kind of excited about Windows 10? Because amid all that bashing there, right, I'm actually kind of excited for it.
I am too.
Yeah?
Cautiously yeah. Optimistic. I don't get too much of a I keep my pants on for the, you know, the previews. I wait for betas and then, you know, I gotta give it a while. I don't like building and rebuilding systems, so listen to people, but cautiously optimistic.
As usual, wait for Service Pack 1.
I can't do that, not with my kit at home, not just here in the office. I've got to be on the latest and greatest, which is why I made the jump to Windows 8, actually. And like I said before, kind of like it. But as soon as Windows 10 comes, I think I'll be having that.
Did you download the preview?
No, I didn't. No, I don't have time for that. I think once like a proper box GA product comes out, then yeah, I'll have it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. I'm a Windows guy through and through. You know, I've just been always been. Well, except for the phone. Yeah, except for the phone, which I hated. But I'm always excited about the new stuff. I wasn't excited about 8, but as a Microsoft employee when I was there, we had to use it, right? It's the dog food thing, right? And after leaving, I'm back on Windows 7, and I like Windows 7 a lot, but I do find myself touching the screen every now and then because it's fast. Just because it's faster than pointing with a mouse or a trackball. I use a trackball instead of a mouse most of the time.
Yeah, I touch the screen in the server room all the time. Nothing happens.
Hey, Mark, if they absolutely nail it with Windows 10, right, and there's apps galore and they go from servers to phones and stuff like that, all of this piss taking that you've been doing about Windows phone apps, are you going to backtrack on that?
Well, I won't backtrack because it's too much fun, but I might stop doing it. But for the time being, it's full speed ahead, man. Damn the torpedoes. It's secret Windows phone apps.
You're not going to have to force us to go back to all the old episodes and edit them out and pretend they didn't exist, yeah?
I'm not going to force you to do that, and I don't think Microsoft will force us to do that. But you know what? I've got an Android phone, and I love it, and I don't think I'm going to change from that.
Yeah, no. Fair play. All right, anything else on Windows?
I was just going to comment that it's like, to be honest, I could care less about the OS anymore. I know we had this discussion on the last episode, but yeah, it was... I just, you know, it's like there's applications that I use and I want those applications to span across the devices that I use. And so that's where it's, you know, an ecosystem that supports that. So for me, the transition to Mac after having been on Windows since roughly 1993 has been somewhat shocking and different because it's, you know, it is really functionally different, you know, from the muscle memory aspects to the way the file system works and everything else. It's been a challenge for me, but I've kind of welcomed something that's a bit of a change, right? And so, you know, I'm sure I will probably end up spinning up a virtual machine with Windows 10 on it at some point, but I can't get too excited anymore about operating systems.
Well, here's the thing. We're at a point in technology today where the device really doesn't matter. The app is what matters. There's pretty broad support. We're not all the way there yet, you know, so it doesn't matter what you're using and but how you get to it. There's plenty of companies now where you've got mixed PC and Windows and Mac and other, you know, the BYOD isn't for everyone, but it's happening. So you're going to see more of that. That's a unavoidable trend, and I'm actually happy about it because there was a time I had an Android phone, I had an iPad, and then I had a Windows PC, and I'm totally good with it. Now I'm Android, Surface, Windows, but it doesn't matter. It's the app that matters, and it's all good in my hood.
Do you know what, though, Rick? And I don't know if I'm understanding you right here because I kind of think I disagree. So I listen to a podcast called All About Android. It's a weekly Twit podcast. And, you know, something that comes up regularly on there is that if you're purchasing an app from the Play Store on Google for an Android phone, and you've got a kind of quirky phone, so, you know, the handheld, the device itself, the hardware, isn't like a Nexus 5 or a Samsung Galaxy, whatever, yeah? And if you're not running the latest version of Android, then they've got loads of stories. They're always saying that you get a bug with it and you're not going to get anything from the application developer because they just don't have the time to support all the different devices, all the different versions of the operating system. You've got to stay on a mainstream device and be running almost the latest version of the operating system. Otherwise, your support experience is going to be pretty crummy.
Well, that's the bad side of the story. You know, I don't disagree with you, but I just think we're in the middle of an incomplete vision where at the end, the app is what matters, and the endpoint, the device, and maybe even how you get to it, Wi-Fi or cell or other, it's just going to not matter at the end. The app will be everywhere. We're close. We're not there yet.
Well, I guess maybe that's what I like about my Android phone is because I get apps now. I don't have to be app poor, right? Like I just, while we were talking earlier, I went to search on the Android store, and yeah, I can get Bash shells.
Yeah,
I can get Bash. I'm sure I can't get Bash for a Windows phone.
Not that you'd want it at the moment, though, right?
Not too
well.
Much.
You could probably make that a new secret Windows phone app. It might involve destroying a device, however.
Hey now.
We did talk about that offline, Mark, didn't we, saying Bash and Linux is getting all the limelight and let's get Windows Phone involved. Let's do a Bash app for it.
Yeah, Windows has had its issues of certainly bugs and stuff over the years. We don't need to add that to it.
So let's talk a bit about this Shell Shock bug then. Kind of funky name, Shell Shock, but should we be shocked at all about it?
No, I don't think so at all. I think, you know, if I hearken back to what the discussion was the other day and I put my tinfoil hat on, I look at a lot of the massive, you know, whether it's Shell Shock or Heartbleed or any of these other things, as there are some people who are going to look at those and say that those are a feature and not a bug. Or backdoor, you know, based on the group that designed it. You know, if we go back and we look at like the Tor network developed by the U.S. Navy, obviously there's going to be a backdoor or something like that in there. Some of these things I think are just, you know, it's like, you know, obviously it was very easy for the NSA or some of these other groups to spy on Americans because they knew full well about some of these exploits that were available. And some of those things came out with the Snowden allegations and things that came out through that.
Yeah, now, I totally like that kind of angle that especially Shell Shock could very, very easily be seen as a potential backdoor for somebody like the NSA or anybody that knows about it to get in and, you know, own you effectively. The only thing that kind of doesn't add up for me in respect to Shell Shock is that this kind of, we'll call it a vulnerability or a feature, whatever, right, has been around for 20 plus years, right? And there are millions and millions of instances of Bash out there, and nobody's noticed. I mean, I that was the thing that shocked me.
Well, I think to Gabriel's point is that people have been using it. You know, it's that vulnerability feature.
Feature. That's what I was snickering at. But well, and then here's the thing: we're all smart, but we're not all smart enough. There's plenty more that we haven't found. And how many things like this, Bash and SSL, how many little components make up the Android base or the Linux base, right? There's like thousands.
The Windows base as well, yeah.
There's just so many. I mean, anytime you're looking at billions of lines of code.
Billions.
Or whatever, you know, whatever the number is, right? You know, you can miss something easily, right? The Q&A, especially for open source type technologies, or technologies where lots of people contribute over the years.
Right.
You know, it's not like, hey, we're selling something and we're responsible. This is something that's in the wild. Anybody can make a change to and make it as part of a kernel. I mean, if you look at there's a really great image out there of, you know, the forking of Linux, right? From the time that it started and going forward with each of the major distros and how many thousand, it's probably literally almost close to 1,000 different flavors of Linux that were distributed over the course of that period of time. Any one of those could have baked something into the kernel.
It's like wild DNA in a cat, you know, it only takes one nasty cat to mess it up. But what I'm getting at though, think of the risk where people could go and contribute just that one bad bit, right? And it's a real risk, and heck, you could even have it in mainstream non-open source software. There's that risk doesn't really go away, but you can almost make the case it was malicious at the time.
Could have been. I've got to say as well, getting code into the mainline Linux kernel is it does go through fairly rigorous checks, and that there is a dictator by the name of Linus Torvalds at the top there who, could be wrong here, but I think he checks most of the code in on his weekly builds and things. But that said, right, you know, an angle on this is that there are so many people and companies out there that have made their, well, their entire livelihood and billions of dollars in some cases based on open source software. You know, there would be probably, I could be wrong about this, there would be no Facebook and no Google and companies like that if there was no Linux and open source non-licensed.
You know, all, you know, Google did, you know, or MapR, or Cassandra, or all these different, you know, distributed type of systems that are out there that are for the most part open source at their very core.
Yeah, and what I'm getting at, though, is that do some of these guys that have made so much money and such huge and great businesses out of it have a bit of a responsibility to put a bit more effort into code checking and checking security and stuff like that, rather than, and I'm not saying that they are just leeching from it, but those guys, you know, on their own internal products and things, will be white hot on the security, surely. Maybe they need to give more back to the community in future.
But that's also why Red Hat has a business model, right? You're buying a kernel, or you're buying a distribution, and the support that comes with it, and the fact that it's been, you know, checked and double checked, and the I's have been dotted and the T's have been crossed, versus the open one, which anybody could download and implement. Which, you know, there's parallels between the two, but the thing is, you're buying a little bit of accountability when you actually pay for what would we deem normally to be open source software.
So I think with the Red Hat thing, you're really just paying for the service, because any changes they make to the code, they have to give back to the community. And thus, you know, that's where CentOS and stuff comes from.
Does anybody know what Red Hat's response was to this bug bash?
What do you mean by response?
Yeah, have they made any comments about what their customers ought to do, or if there's anything that they need to do, or...
Yeah, so I know that they were quick out, well, fairly quick out with a patch, which didn't fully patch it, actually. And then I think in total they've had 3 patches, and the advice to customers is get those patches on as sharp as you can.
Yeah, their Bugzilla had it listed as, you know, 9.14 when it came on board, modified on 10.2. I mean, they're continually updating that Bugzilla around that.
Well, okay. You know, if you're looking for advice, just go Larry Ellison style. There's way more money in non-open source. You know, you could buy an island. Larry Lanai Island. Now.
98% of an island.
Oh, sorry. .98 Larry Lanai. You know, so there's way more money in the non-free stuff if there's any encouragement needed for the world.
Speaking of the non-free stuff there at Oracle, then those guys have just released a storage platform. if there was ever Franken-storage in the modern day, right? Because we've seen Franken-storage a lot in the past, but I kind of thought we were getting away from that. It looks like this hash of a pillar axiom, if I understand it right, as some kind of... Anybody got any positive thoughts on the, is it FS12? I can't even get my head around the name.
It looks like that, right? It looks like it's FS1-2. I mean, how are you supposed to say this?
Is that how it is, or is there an FS1 and an FS2? And that's I don't know. And I've done a fair bit of reading around it.
Effing stupid, 1 and 2. I mean...
There you go. Brilliant.
But you did some reading, but I seem to recall you had some problems getting through it, though.
Yeah, you know what? So that's a good story, Mark. So last night when we were recording the original version of the podcast, I was trying to do a bit of research on this FS1-2, whatever shenanigans that's come out of Oracle Storage. And I was so bored reading it. I was literally nodding off to sleep. I pulled my phone out of my pocket and I thought, I've got the podcast in 45 minutes. I'll set an alarm for 15 minutes before the podcast in case I fall asleep. Bingo. I fell asleep reading the article. It's like it was so dry. It was like 10 years ago, right? Speeds and feeds, Gabriel. You're absolutely right. Nobody cares about them anymore. Nobody believes them. And it was literally a mixture of feeds and speeds plus a bunch of, we're going to tear Xtreme IO apart. 8 point whatever times the IOPS and 10 times the throughput. And I'm like, boring speeds and feeds, absolute rubbish. I'm sure EMC are quaking in their boots about this. Not.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, in what we discussed the other day about it was that it was purpose-built Oracle storage.
Because that's the only place they can sell it, right?
And that's, you know, I mean, do they really want to become a general purpose storage, commodity storage broker, monolithic storage broker? I mean, I don't think so. I think their install base is big enough. And what the one thing that the Oracle has always done well, and I think we discussed this yesterday, was that they've catered to their install base from a standpoint of how can we continue to squeeze extra revenue out of you.
Right now, on. Right on. They milk their customers better than anybody.
As Exadata and that platform starts to get long in the tooth, we can look at some other solution that is going to, you know, I mean, the nefarious aspect of it is that we're constantly designing the next product to replace the current product that you need to migrate from. So you're going to get you for the hardware, the software support, the services to migrate, and everything else under the sun, right?
Everything else.
That's how you can buy a $500 million island.
.98 Larry Lanai, free trip included with all new purchases.
Yeah, who knows? They'll probably get into catering, too, one of these days and do lunchrooms.
Oh, could you imagine if Larry ran a bar? That would be crazy.
You'd have to pay to go take a leak.
Man, yeah, pay for ice.
It's like the pay bathrooms, right, that you see at some places, right?
But it would probably be really, really good.
Nice bathroom, though.
Yeah.
Guys, I've got to tell you this story about a pay bathroom, right? And we'll come back on piste in a second. Oh, yeah. So I used to work in Leeds, town in the north of England, and I finished work one day, and I ran to the train station to get my train, and I got there, and I was absolutely bursting for a number two. That works in the States, right, yeah?
I am sorry. Do we want to continue?
We've got to continue, right? So there were turnstiles to get into the toilets, and you needed to put a 20 pence piece in to get in, and I did not have a 20 pence piece, and I was like hopping on the spot, touching cloth, okay?
And you were like turtle. trying to pinch that 20 pence piece.
Absolutely. So I hurdle the barrier to get into the toilet, and I am faced with three pots to sit on, but no cubicles around them. So there are just like marks in the wall where there used to be cubicles. And I'm like, these cubicles are just out in the open.
Good thing you didn't pay.
You're right, I didn't actually. But I'm thinking, you know, paying customers would not be happy about this. So I got to go and pull my pants down, sit on this toilet while guys are just walking in and like staring at me. And I'm like, hey.
That's like a worst nightmare. The only thing worse would be put that up on stage. That's the worst thing that could happen.
You know what? If I wasn't so desperate at the time, there is no way I would have done that. But that's just like the third world. I thought, what?
Was that new food court that you went to? The new mall with the restaurant that the kitchen was just figuring it out and you got sick?
No, it was not. No, no. That's a different story for another time, that is. But bring it back to Oracle, okay?
There ought to be some sort of joke about Leeds, but I just can't put it together.
The lose of Leeds.
Well, it's a different topic, but there's kind of a story. So Leeds United is a football team that spent a lot of money a lot of years ago to try and make it. I mean, they spent a lot of money, and they were pushing for like the Premiership title and stuff. It didn't work, and they are now a bankrupt club that are struggling in the lower divisions. And I've had quite a few conversations on Twitter with people wondering whether or not Pure Storage will do a Leeds United. Because they are taking a lot of money, and if they don't pull it off and start winning customers faster, they're going to do a Leeds, I think.
Well, but I mean, I think what they'll end up doing is probably not necessarily a pivot, but they're going to have to bring something out outside of just being flash storage.
Oh, man, but that's a lot of R&D, and that doesn't happen overnight.
No, but, you know, when you get $400 million in VC funding, you know, that buys a lot of, you know, R&D, put it that way.
But it doesn't buy time and development cycle. I don't think you can compress that very much, personally.
No, no. I mean,
all the money in the world.
Very, very few companies can actually buy an accelerated development cycle, right? And that's probably why you see certain companies being bought instead of, you know, being replicated.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, cause
so, Nigel, I was just going to say, so are these comments, or are they showing up from EMC employees, or where?
What comments are those?
Well, the comments about Pure Storage.
Oh, no, no. You know what? I'll dig it out and maybe put it in the show notes when I put the podcast up on the website. I can't remember who it was that I was talking. I've had a couple of conversations on Twitter. I'll go dig them out. But no, they weren't EMC employees, no.
Okay.
So why don't we switch gears a little bit and talk about activist investors? Because there's been a bunch of that being talked about.
Actually, Nigel, I just want to say one thing back to where we were.
Go on.
Hang on a second. Sorry about this. So actually, if we're going to summarize this experience, Nigel, that, you know, we had the podcast fail last night, but you were asleep right up until the time we were going to record the podcast. It's possible that your preparation for the podcast was impacted by reading this boring dreck from Oracle on the FS12, and that in some ways the FS12 is responsible for our podcast failure last night.
Clearly.
On that topic, I was thinking Microsoft was responsible. So I reckon I've recorded 50 podcasts in my time, okay? And I have never had a failure with Skype until now. Microsoft by Skype, we've done 3 podcasts, right? Well, 3.5 considering this one. I did have a problem on episode 1, if you guys remember, right at the beginning, and we had to kick the call off again. And then episode 3, I had an epic fail. So I'm blaming Microsoft. Mark, you can blame Oracle. Rick, you can blame yourself for not being my backup recorder,
yep,
right?
Yep, I failed the backup.
And we can't blame you for anything, Gabe, because you're an ever-present on the show and we don't want to piss you off.
Nigel, you got it wrong. Hans isn't here to blame him.
Yeah, that's right. Let's do that.
Definitely the Hulk.
So, shall we talk about activist investors? I know you've got some opinions on this, Gabriel, and you do too, Mark.
No, I mean, the bigger discussion that we had around the activist investor, you know, obviously was the discussion around Elliott Investments and what they were doing with EMC, you know, and if that was the big push, you know, it's like, oh, we're going to break up VMware, you know, we're going to push VMware out, we're going to, you know, we're going to force Joe out, and then we're going to, you know, we're going to sell EMC off to somebody else. I mean, it's like, you know, talk about things that are kind of ludicrous on their face to an extent, especially if you ask the EMC people, you know, but they do have a purpose, right? If you look at somebody like Elliott, who's gone into several companies, and I worked at Emulex when they came in as an activist investor to shake it up. And they actually got a good portion of what they wanted, right? They had change in the board, change in the CEO, a reduction of around 30% on costs and spending within the organization. They do have an ability, you know, to buy a certain amount or percentage of a company and actually impact the direction. And so it's not something to be taken completely lightly, right?
How much did they have of Emulex at the time? Do you remember?
9.8%. Now, that's a fairly, you know, I mean, that's, I don't know if that's, you know, can we nominate somebody for the board? But if you get somebody come in and buy 10% of a company and they can start influencing other voting members, and obviously everybody who's a shareholder is a voting member at some point, and you get enough of those people to say, hey, you know what? I do want them to turn around and reinvest some of that money or buy back some stock and increase the share price so I can offload this property that I have. Right? And that's that's what ends up happening.
So, and it's what obviously ended up happening with eBay and PayPal. Carl Icahn came in, bought a bunch of it, and I was forcing the sale of PayPal.
Which is in the news at the moment, right?
Yeah, that's this week.
And do you think that makes sense?
You know, I think it probably does. I'm not that close to it. It's not enterprise technology, but I think it probably is.
Okay, so on enterprise though, Mark, do you think it would be a good idea for EMC to shed VMware?
Oh boy, what a great question. Certainly not a good idea for EMC, but it's possible that VMware could be sold at quite a premium. I'm not sure. You know, it's always a matter of who's going to buy it and what would they do. I mean, I think people would probably, I think the buyers would probably line up to get their paws on VMware right now. But I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, it's you think about it this way, it's like, you know, talk about great investments, right? Here is VMware purchased for what, something roughly around $640 million back in 2004. A company that does, you know, how many billions, $7 to $9 billion a year in annual run rate business. You know, and that's continual, right? And obviously, you know, back then, EMC was taking a very large bet in buying 80% of VMware. It was still test and dev. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't vSphere. It wasn't what it is today. It wasn't the juggernaut. But they had some, you know, EMC has done one thing pretty well, I will say, is how they've bet on specific technologies that they've purchased or invested in and brought them to market.
Yeah, they're good at it. They're real good at it.
And the way they integrate as well.
Right. There are very few misses if you look at that portfolio. You know, if we look at, you know, possibly NetApp and Spinnaker and some of these other things, right? Those are...
Talk about polar opposites.
Sorry, guys.
But, you know, there are certain, you know, groups that have not done well at integrating a solution. I mean, HP and autonomy, right? You know, let's talk about some of the big failures. And when you look at some things that EMC done, and, you know, the funny thing is, I've never managed an EMC environment in my entire career. I have really very little physical hands-on experience with their products and technologies. But I do know, out of the number of people that I know that work there, they do focus on specific things that make the customer continue to rebuy the product, right? And I think that it's kind of, you know, I look at their purchase of DSSD. That's stuff that is exciting. I mean, for the storage nerd in me, that type of stuff has some long-standing ramifications. They're always looking not just, you know, to the next quarter. They're looking to several years down the road. And, you know, Cisco and some of the other companies are the same way.
To be fair to HP, they did buy 3PAR, and 3PAR's worked out really well for them.
It saved them in storage. Prior to that, what did they have?
EVA.
They give left hand away today. It's not like they can even sell it anymore.
Nigel said the letters, they were EVA.
That was a good technology, actually, under Compaq, and they let that die a death under HP. And what else did they have? That OEM deal with Hitachi? I mean, you're right, 3PAR saved their storage division there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, how different would the storage landscape look like today if Dell had won the 3PAR battle?
Oh, totally, yeah.
You know, Compellent was kind of a runner-up, right?
Yeah, and you know what? I think that HP and 3PAR was a much better fit than 3PAR and Dell. And it almost worked out the way it should have done, because 3PAR was the more enterprise of the two products, if you will. And I think HP was the more enterprise high end of the companies. And Dell, great company, don't get me wrong, and Compellent, great technology as well, but pitched at more of a lower end of the market, I think, or smaller customers, if you will.
Different scopes, right? Because, you know, I mean, all three, you know, the major OEMs, they can all go into any organization and compete on different levels, right? But, you know, I definitely think that HP had the kind of sales force and storage team behind it that could actually take something like 3PAR and build upon it instead of just milking it.
Hey, here's a good question for you then. If a merger, an acquisition, whatever, of HP and EMC went ahead, what would happen to the storage portfolio? Which one would continue and which one wouldn't?
You know, I couldn't ever see that happening, to be honest. I think those companies are such two polar opposites. I mean, you would basically have two sales forces that joined together and basically fought each other to the death before they could actually sell a single product, right? It would be like that scene in Anchorman when they, you know, the different news teams assemble. You know, it's like, I killed a man with a trident. There will be several people wielding tridents at that meeting, right?
But one of you guys, humor me. I know, I don't think it'd be a great fit as a company, but which of the two storage portfolios would win?
EMC's, because it's so much bigger.
Yeah.
And it's their singular focus for the vast majority of it, right? If you listen to the EMC people talk about it, you know, they're a software company now. Very few of what they're doing, very few of the platforms they're developing, delivering today are based on custom hardware. They are looking at, you know, if you look at Viper and some of the other things and Scale.io and some of these other technologies, they are kind of going towards a more commodity hardware with a software layer on top. And we make all of that, you know, we wrap it up in a wrapper and deliver it to you.
But you know what? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Gabriel.
Whereas, you know, 3PAR is still very much hardware driven with the ASIC design.
But one of the things that EMC does really well is they bring in new technologies. And say if EMC were to control the storage environment, they let them run. They get a lot of revenue out of products without integrating them in necessarily, right? They let them be their own thing. The problem is of course you'd have competing products, you know, to customers. But for those customers that bought a lot of 3PAR, I doubt that they would try to convert them right away to EMC technology.
Yeah, I think I agree. A little bit like the way HP have been with 3PAR and customers that had the Hitachi box, the P9500,
yep.
They didn't go straight in and try and rip all of that out. They're happy for those customers to continue with that. And then over time, and I think now they're starting to say, right, and because they've got more margin on it, right, but push the 3PAR line.
Yeah. You know, it certainly there'd be key individuals that would leave in that sort of acquisition.
Calvin Zito?
Well, I was thinking more like David Scott.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
No, that would definitely be the big one.
But he's done well out of it anyway, so.
I think it's kind of silly discussion. I just could not see HP and EMC merging as two companies. It just, there's nothing about that. That's not peanut butter and jelly. That's peanut butter and mayo.
Oh. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I don't think it would happen at all either. Bit of a silly discussion. Anything else for the show, guys?
I don't think so.
I think we're good.
Cool. So I think we'll finish off the show with another secret Windows phone app.
Hello, this is Mark Farley, and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret.
I love it.
In fact, it's so secret, you could say, it gets inside of you. And it's the kind of app that you would only use a Windows phone for.
Yeah!
Because you would never see an Apple fanboy use their phone for something like this.
Ah!
They're too inhibited. And Android phone users are too busy. But nobody should be too inhibited or busy for a little personal hygiene or grooming. Like the Windows Secret Nose Camera app. The Nose Camera app is very handy for looking inside your nostrils to see if you have any big, long nose hairs that stick out that other people might be noticing. And it's really easy to use. You just look for the lens on the camera on the back of your phone, and you put it under your nostril, and you take a picture. That's all there is to it. It's really simple. And then you look at the pictures, and you can see if there's any hairs that are longer than any others, or any that are, like, sticking way out, or maybe look weird, you know. And then you can cut them or pull them out at the root while looking at the picture of your nose on your phone. And then, after you've done the procedure, you can take another picture and then do A-B before and after comparison and upload those to your OneDrive. And it's really cool if you have nostril screws. Now make sure not to confuse this Secret Windows Phone app with the Nose Hair Trimmer DVR, which is not a Windows Phone app at all, but it's a secret camera embedded in a nose hair trimmer. Like if you're a spy or something. Just look on Google for Nose Hair Trimmer DVR and you'll find it. But if I were you, I wouldn't put my secret nose hair pictures on Google Drive, because Google might end up sharing them with people I don't want to see them. Tune in again for another Secret Windows Phone Apps.